This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin. We Solve Murders by Richard Osman. Read by Nicola Walker. You must leave as few clues as possible. That's the only rule. You have to talk to people sometimes. It's inevitable. There are orders to be given, shipments to be arranged, people to be killed, etc., etc. You cannot exist in a vacuum, for goodness sake. You need to ring François Loubet in an absolute emergency. You'll get a phone with a voice changer built in. And, by the way, if it's not an absolute emergency, you'll regret ringing very soon. But most communication is by message or email. High-end criminals are much like millennials in that way. Everything is encrypted, naturally. But what if the authorities break the code? It happens. A lot of very good criminals are in prison right now because a nerd with a laptop had too much time on their hands. So you must hide as well as you can. You can hide your IP address. That is very easy. François Loubet's emails go through a world tour of different locations before being sent. Even a nerd with a laptop would never be able to discover from where they were actually sent. But everyone's language leaves a unique signature. A particular use of words, a rhythm, a personality. Someone could read an email and then read a postcard you sent in 2009 and know for a fact they were sent by the same person. Science, you see? So often the enemy of the honest criminal. That's why ChatGPT has been such a godsend. After writing an email, a text, anything really, you can simply run the whole thing through ChatGPT and it instantly deletes your personality. It flattens you out, irons your creases, washes you away, quirk by quirk, until you disappear. ChatGPT. Rewrite in the style of a friendly English gentleman, please. That is always Loubet's prompt. Handy, because if these emails were written in François Loubet's own language, it would all become much more obvious. Too obvious. But as it stands, you might find 1,000 emails, but you would still have no way of knowing where François Loubet was, and you would still have no way of knowing who François Loubet is. You would, of course, know what François Loubet does, but there would be precious little you could do about it. Part 1. From the New Forest to South Carolina. Chapter 1. It had finally happened. Andrew Fairbanks had always known he would be famous one day, and that day, a quiet, sunny Tuesday in early August, had at last arrived. The years of Instagram fitness videos had given him a following, sure, but nothing like this. This was insane. There had been an on-off relationship with a minor pop singer, which had seen his picture in the papers from time to time, but not on the front pages like today. The notoriety Andrew Fairbanks had chased for so long was finally his. His name on lips around the world, trending on social media. That selfie on the yacht was everywhere. Andrew, shirtless and tanned, winking into the camera. The warm sun winking along behind him. His bottle of Crusher energy drink raised in a happy toast. And the comments beneath the photo. The heart emojis, the fire emojis. The lust. Everything Andrew had ever dreamt of. Some of the other comments might have dampened his spirits a little, however. Gone too soon. So fit, R.I.P. So haunting to see that photo when you knew what was about to happen. But you couldn't argue with the volume. Impressive traffic. In the offices of the Love Island production team, his photograph was passed around and there were discussions about how perfect he might have been if only, well, you know. Yes, finally, everybody knew Andrew Fairbanks. Or, as he was now more commonly known, tragic Instagram influencer Andrew Fairbanks. So it wasn't all upside. And, in fact, even that slim upside is beginning to dim. It is Wednesday afternoon by now, and his name is already beginning to slip down the rankings. Other things are happening in the world. A baseball star has driven his pickup into his ex-wife's swimming pool. A beauty vlogger has said something inappropriate about Taylor Swift. The conversation, like the tide, is turning. Andrew Fairbanks had been found dead. Shot in the head, tied to a rope, and thrown from a yacht bobbing about in the Atlantic. There was no one else on the yacht, and no sign that anyone had ever been there, with the exception of a leather bag containing nearly $1 million. But none of this gives you the right to be famous more than a day or so. One day, perhaps, there might be a podcast about the case, or, better still, a Netflix true crime documentary. But, for now, Andrew's limelight is turning to dusk. Soon, Andrew Fairbanks will be just a figure in a photograph, holding a purple energy drink in front of a blue sea, a corpse in a South Carolina mortuary, and the odd, "Remember that guy that died on that yacht with all that money?" Who killed him? Who knows? Someone or other, certainly. And social media has a lot of opinions on it. Why did they kill him? No idea. Someone must have had their reasons, mustn't they? Jealous partner? Instagram fitness rival? Could be all sorts of explanations. Can you believe what this vlogger has said about Taylor Swift? Just for the one day, though, what a ride it had been. If Andrew had still been alive, he would have been looking for a full-time manager. Get me a few more deals, protein bars, teeth whitening clinics. Perhaps I could launch my own vodka. Yes, just for a day, everybody had wanted a piece of Andrew Fairbanks. Although, after the sharks had finished with him, there weren't that many pieces left. And that's show business. Chapter 2.
"What don't you like about yourself?" asks Rosie D'Antonio.
She sits on an inflatable chair shaped like a throne, in a swimming pool shaped like a swan.
I always ask people.
Amy Wheeler is sitting, bolt upright, on a garden chair at the poolside, the sun in her eyes and her gun within easy reach. She likes South Carolina, this hidden offshoot of it at least. Early morning and the temperature in the 90s, an Atlantic breeze, and nobody for the time being trying to kill her. She hasn't shot at anyone in a while, but you can't have everything.
"My nose, I suppose," says Amy. "What's wrong with your nose?" asks Rosie, sipping something green through a non-recyclable straw, her trailing hand rippling the water.
"Don't know," says Amy.
She is impressed that Rosie D'Antonio is in full, perfect makeup while in the pool. How old is she? 60? 80? A mystery. The age on her file reads, "Refused to disclose."
"It's just wrong. When I look at it, it's off."
"Get it done," says Rosie.
"Bigger, smaller, whatever you think you need. Life's too short not to like your nose.
Hunger and famine are problems, or no Wi-Fi. Noses aren't a problem. What else?"
"Hair," says Amy.
She is in danger of relaxing, feels it creeping up on her. Amy hates relaxing. Too much time to think. She prefers to do.
"Never does what is told."
"I see that," says Rosie.
"But it's easily fixed. There's a hair technician I use. She flies in from somewhere.
Chilly, I think."
$5,000, and your troubles are over.
I'll pay."
"And my ears are lopsided?" says Amy.
Rosie tilts her head and paddles herself towards Amy, considering her very carefully.
"I'm not seeing that."
"You have great ears, like Goldie Hawn's,"
I measured them with a ruler once, says Amy, when I was at school. It's only a millimetre, but I always see it. And my legs are too short for my body. Rosie nods, pushing herself back into the middle of the pool where the sun is hitting hardest. More to the point, though, Amy, what do you like about yourself? I'm English, says Amy. I don't like anything about myself.
Yawn, says Rosie. I used to be English too, and I got over it.
Pick something. I think I'm loyal, says Amy.
That's a good quality, agrees Rosie. For a bodyguard.
And my short legs give me a low centre of gravity, says Amy. So I'm very good at fighting.
There you go, Rosie nods. Loyal and very good at fighting.
Rosie raises her face to the sun.
If someone does try to shoot me this week, do you have to dive in front of the bullet?
That's the idea, says Amy without conviction, though that's mainly in films. It's hard to dive in front of a bullet, in Amy's experience. They go very fast indeed.
Or in books, sure, says Rosie.
Would you like a joint?
I'm going to have one.
Best not, says Amy. Maximum Impact gives us mandatory blood tests every 3 months, company policy. Single trace of any drug and I'm fired. Rosie gives a fair enough grunt. It's not the most exciting job Amy has ever had, but it's sunny and she likes the client. Rosie D'Antonio, the world's best-selling novelist, if you don't count Lee Child. Her Spanish-style mansion on her own private island just off the coast of South Carolina, with her own personal chef. For various operational reasons, Amy once had to spend the best part of a month living inside an abandoned oil pipeline in Syria, so this is a step up. The chef brings her a plate of smoked salmon blinis. He's not really a chef. He's a former Navy SEAL called Kevin, but he is learning fast. Last night, his bœuf bourguignon was a triumph. Rosie's regular chef has been given 2 weeks' leave. Amy, Rosie, and Kevin, the Navy SEAL, are the only people on the island. And that's how it's going to stay for now. No one's allowed to kill me, says Rosie. She has paddled over to the side of the pool and is now rolling a cigarette. Except me.
And I won't let you, says Amy.
But someone might try to shoot me, says Rosie.
Given one never knows anymore, the world being as it is and so on. So if they do try, no jumping in front of the bullet, okay? Not on my account.
Let them kill the old woman. Maximum Impact Solutions, Amy's employer, is the world's biggest close protection agency. Possibly the second biggest since Henk Van Veen left and took half his clients with him. If someone steals from you, or someone wants to kill you, or if there is discontent among your private army, they are the people to call. Maximum Impact Solutions has many mottos, but let them kill the old woman is not one of them. I'm not going to let anybody kill you, says Amy. Amy remembers watching Rosie on the communal TV when she was growing up. Those shoulder pads, that attitude. It had meant a lot to Amy, seeing how strong a woman could be, while she slept each night curled up in a ball under her bed and dreamt of better days. Rosie will not die on her watch.
What's that accent? Asks Rosie, taking the first drag on her joint.
It's cute. Is it Manchester?
Watford, says Amy.
Yeesh, says Rosie. I've been gone too long. Tell me about Watford.
It's a town, says Amy, in England. I know that, Amy.
Is it pretty?
It's not the first word I'd use, says Amy. She's looking forward to ringing her father-in-law, Steve, later. It's a Friday, so he should be around. He'll get a kick out of hearing about Rosie. Strong women had certainly been his thing. Maybe they will be again one day. Thinking about strong women makes Amy think about Bella Sanchez, and thinking about Bella Sanchez makes her think about Mark Gooch, and thinking about Mark Gooch makes her... And that's the problem right there, Amy, isn't it? When you relax, you think. None of that stuff is her business. Stop thinking. It never works out for you. Hit things, drive fast, diffuse explosives, but for the love of God, don't think. Life isn't school.
England is nuts, says Rosie. In the 80s, they loved me. Then in the 90s, they hated me. In the noughties, they forgot me. In the 2010s, they remembered me. And now they love me again. I haven't changed a jot in all that time.
You ever read any of my books?
Amy the Bodyguard.
No, lies Amy. Everyone has read one of Rosie D'Antonio's books. Amy has been reading her books since she was a teenager. A social worker once handed one to her, a finger on their lips to warn Amy that this contraband was their little secret. And what a secret. The death, the glamour, the clothes, the blood, shoulder pads and poison. But it's important not to fangirl a client. A bullet doesn't care how famous you are, which actually is one of Maximum Impact Solutions' mottos. Amy had been rereading Death Pulls the Trigger on the plane up here yesterday. They'd made a film of it with Angelina Jolie, but the book was better. Lots of sex with millionaires, lots of guns. Stuff Amy could relate to.
You married? Rosie asks. Kids?
Married, no kids, says Amy.
He a good guy, the husband?
Yeah, he is, says Amy, thinking of Adam. As good as I am, anyway. I like him. Rosie nods.
That's a good answer. Does he worry about you?
He doesn't like it when I get shot at, says Amy.
And once in Morocco I got attacked with a sword and he cried. Did you cry?
I haven't cried since I was 12, says Amy.
I learnt not to. That sounds healthy, says Rosie.
Can I put you in a book? 5'6", blue eyes, blonde, never cries, kills bad guys.
No, says Amy. I don't like publicity. I promise not to mention your ears.
Amy and her father-in-law try to talk every day. They've never really discussed it. It's just become a habit important to both of them. Well, it's a habit important to Amy, and she hopes it's important to Steve too. Occasionally they'll miss a day. For example, Amy had to stay completely quiet for 12 hours in that oil pipeline on account of a hit squad. So on that day, she had to make do with texting. Steve understands. The job is the job.
Do you get to choose what you wear? Rosie asks. Or is it a uniform?
Amy looks down at her combat fatigues and faded Under Armour t-shirt. I choose.
Rosie raises a questioning eyebrow. Well, nobody's perfect.
Amy doesn't like to leave it too long between calls because you never knew what Steve was eating, if he was looking after himself. It is illogical, in her opinion, to eat poorly. She should probably ring her husband too, but she worries less about Adam. And besides, what would they talk about?
When you came in, says Rosie, there was a copy of Death Pulls the Trigger at the top of your bag. Thumbed through to about halfway.
Amy nods.
Busted. So you have read one of my books. You said you hadn't.
Client research.
Bullshit, says Rosie. You like it?
There was nothing else to read.
Of course you like it. I see you. You read the bit where she shoots the guy on the plane?
That's a good bit, says Amy.
Yeah, that's a good bit, says Rosie, nodding. A pilot I was seeing let me shoot a gun on his plane for research. Have you ever done that?
Shot a gun on a plane? No, lies Amy.
Nothing really happens, says Rosie. They had to replace the calfskin on one of the sofas, but that was it.
If it had pierced the fuselage, the cabin could have depressurized and you could have all died, says Amy.
Amy had once parachuted out of a plane after exactly such an incident. She had spent the next 5 days evading rebel forces in Burkina Faso.
Actually, a lot of fun in the end. Amy finds adrenaline good for the soul and very good for the skin. Sometimes she watches skincare tutorials on Instagram, but there's not a single one that will do for your skin what being shot at and then jumping out of a plane will do. Perhaps she should do her own videos. Again, she finds that she is thinking,
and so she stops.
Lucky it didn't then, says Rosie, knocking back the rest of whatever goop is sitting in her glass.
I'm getting itchy feet, Amy. Can we go somewhere on the mainland? Have a drink.
Raise a bit of hell.
Rosie's troubles had started when she had included a character in her most recent novel, Dead Men and Diamonds, very clearly based on a Russian chemicals oligarch named Vasily Karpin. Vasily, it seemed, had lacked the sense of humour one usually associates with chemicals billionaires, and after a bullet in the post and a botched abduction at a Nashville book signing, Rosie had called in the professionals and was confined to barracks for the foreseeable future. People are talking to people. Jeff Nolan, Amy's boss, has reached out to some of Vasily's colleagues in London. Conversations are ongoing. Vasily will be persuaded to drop this particular vendetta soon enough. Maximum Impact Solutions has clients who could do him a few favours. An accommodation will be found. Vasily will be placated, and Rosie will be free to go about her business again. And if not, Amy will be ready. Until then, Amy and Rosie are stuck on this idyllic island with their hastily trained executive chef. Amy could definitely use a few days here. Probably needs the rest, if she's being honest. But she'll need to be back on the move soon. No one is going to kill Rosie D'Antonio, so Amy is essentially just a very expensive babysitter. And where's the fun in that for either of them?
We're going nowhere for the moment, says Amy. You might get murdered.
Rosie rolls her eyes and starts to roll another joint.
Oh, Amy. I'd rather be murdered than bored.
And on that point, Amy Wheeler, who spent so much of her childhood trying to be as quiet and as small as possible, is inclined to agree.
Chapter 3.
Cat, ginger, unapproachable, haughty even, the little bugger. Mason's Lane. Contact attempted but rebuffed. 3:58 a.m.
Steve puts his dictaphone back in his pocket. He hears the sound of the ginger cat inexpertly scaling a back fence. It was not often he saw an unfamiliar cat on his walk. It was almost certainly nothing. But almost everything was almost certainly nothing, wasn't it? And yet some things did eventually turn out to be something. He once caught an armed robber because of a Twix wrapper in a blast furnace. One rarely knows the significance of things at the time, and it doesn't cost a penny piece to note things down. Steve turns left onto the top of the high street and sees it stretch out like an unspooling grey ribbon before him, lit by the dim bulb of the moon. If you were to visit Axley, and you should, you'd like it, you might think you had found the perfect English village. A gently sloping high street, looping around a touch at the bottom where it skirts the bank of the village pond. There are two pubs, the Brass Monkey and the Flagon, identical to the tourists, but teeming with subtle and important differences to the locals. For example, one flies a Union Jack and the other the Ukrainian flag. There's a butcher, a baker, no candlestick maker, but you will find a little gift shop selling scented candles and bookmarks. Striped awnings, bicycles leant against shop fronts, chalk boards promising cream teas or tarot readings or dog treats. There is a church at the top of the village and a small bookmaker's at the bottom of the village. Take your pick. Steve used to visit both and now visits neither. And all around, there is the New Forest. The forest is the whole point of the place. The village itself simply found itself a small clearing and settled in. There are walks and trails, the chirrup and buzz of wildlife, and the backpacks and rain mats of the tourists. Stray New Forest ponies some days wander onto the main road and are accorded due reverence. It was their forest long before it was yours, and it will be theirs long afterwards too. Axley simply shelters among the trees, curled into a little nutshell. When Steve first moved here, 12 years ago, was it? Something like that.
Debbie would remember. Probably 15, the way time goes. It hadn't fooled him for a second. Steve hadn't been hoodwinked by the hollyhocks and the cupcakes and the cheery good morning greetings. Steve had seen secrets behind every pastel front door, seen corpses in every back alley, and every time the church bells rang in the hour, Steve had heard the chimes of death. A crisp packet has blown into a hedge. Steve retrieves it and places it in a bin. Monster Munch. They don't sell Monster Munch in the local shop, so that will have been a tourist. No, Steve had refused to be fooled by Axley. 25 years in the police force had taught him to always think the worst of everyone and everything. Always expect the worst, and you'll always be prepared. Never let anyone or anything take you by surprise. Ironic, given what soon happened. Steve stops by the window of the estate agent and peers through the glass. If he was moving to the village today, he wouldn't be able to afford it. The only way anyone can afford to buy a house these days is to have bought it 15 years ago. Steve had been wrong about Axley. He'd be the first to admit it. There were no murderers lurking behind the doors, no mutilated corpses in blood-soaked alleys. And thus, Steve had begun to relax. Steve had never relaxed as a child. His dad had made sure of that. School? Too bright to fit in, but not bright enough to get out. Then joining the Metropolitan Police at the age of 18, seeing the worst that London had to offer day after day. Sometimes this included his own colleagues. Every day a fight. Steve takes out his dictaphone once more. Pale blue Volkswagen Passat registration number PN17DFQ in car park of the Brass Monkey. Steve walks around the car. An ancient tax disc. There is the wrapper from a Greggs in the footwell. Where is the nearest Greggs? Southampton? The services on the M27? He resumes his walk. He will go as far as the pond, sit there for a while, then head back up. Of course he will. That's what Steve does every night. Axley had transformed Steve. Not all at once, but smile by smile, favour by favour, and scone by scone, the people and the place had taken down the wall that he had built up over so many years. Debbie had told him it would, and he hadn't believed her. She had been born here, and when Steve finally left the Met, she had persuaded him to make the move. She knew. Steve had worried there would be no excitement, no adrenaline, but Debbie had reassured him. If you get bored, we're only 20 miles from Southampton, and there are plenty of murders there. But Steve didn't miss the excitement, and he didn't miss the adrenaline. Steve liked to stay in. He liked to cook for Debbie. He liked to hear birdsong. He found himself a solid pub quiz team. Good. But improvable. A stray cat, a proper bruiser, came to visit them and refused to leave. After a week or two of snarling and bullying from both Steve and the cat, they each let down their guard. And now you'll find Steve reading his paper in an old armchair, Trouble curled up on his lap, purring in his sleep. Two old rascals, safe and sound. Debbie persuaded him to set up his agency. He was happy not working. She was bringing in enough money from painting. But she was right. He probably needed something to do, and probably needed to contribute something to the community. The name of his agency, Steve Investigates, was his idea. He remembers a Sunday lunch when his boy, Adam, had come round with his wife, Amy. Amy is a bodyguard. Works with billionaires and oligarchs, always on the other side of the world. Adam does something or other with money. Steve speaks to Amy more than he speaks to Adam. She's the one who rings. She's the one who makes sure they visit if she's in England on a job. Amy had told him to call the company Maverick Steel International Investigations. Branding is very important in the world of private investigations, she had said. But Steve had countered that his name was Steve, and he investigates things, And if that wasn't a brand, what was?
Amy is working with Rosie D'Antonio, the author, somewhere or other in America.
Steve will play it cool when he next talks to Amy, but he will want all the gossip.
There's always gossip when she's protecting celebrities. Once Amy was working with a singer in a boy band, and he took heroin on an elephant.
Google America time difference, says Steve into his dictaphone.
Steve investigates, keeps him pleasantly busy and adequately afloat. He has a few contacts with insurance companies. If you've ever claimed a year's salary because of a bad back anywhere in the New Forest, Steve has probably sat outside your house at some point, perhaps followed you to the gym. It makes Steve happy to find that people are almost always telling the truth about these things. He'll look into affairs if you really, really want him to. His only rule is that he won't travel any distance. Steve doesn't want to stray too far from Axley. He'll drive up to Brockenhurst if you need him to. Couple of nice pubs up there. At a push, he'll head over towards Ringwood or down towards Lymington, but ask him to go to Southampton or Portsmouth, and Steve will politely decline. Get yourself involved in a murder case, say, and before you know it, your time is not your own. Steve never misses the Wednesday night quiz at the Brass Monkey now. A murder would almost certainly get in the way of that at some point. No, thank you. Steve reaches the pond and takes his customary seat. Debbie's favourite. The ducks love this bench, but they are all safely asleep now, tucked up like the rest of the village, Steve keeping watch over them all. Least he can do after everything Axley has done for him. Steve still remembers that feeling of relaxation, of finally letting life settle around him, of trusting that people wished him well, and that each day would bring happiness, of feeling safe. It didn't work out that way, of course. When does it? In one sense, Debbie's death hadn't taken him by surprise. He'd mentally prepared for it every day since they'd fallen in love. That something would surely take her away. Cancer, heart disease, a car hitting her bike on a country road, a stroke, burglars. Something would steal his immense good luck at loving her and being loved by her. In the end, it had been a train carriage that derailed as it approached a country station. There had been three people on the platform, Debbie and two other poor souls, who left their lives behind that rainy January day. And despite his assiduous preparation, it had taken him by surprise. You can think something often enough, but you will never be prepared for your heart disintegrating. After Debbie's death, the village gathered around him, carried him through. Walking through this village, where he knows everyone and everyone knows him, Steve is grateful that at least he feels loved. Because if you don't feel loved, it's difficult to feel anything at all. A lone pony wanders by the side of the pond, head bobbing as he walks. Steve eyes him suspiciously. Well, Steve eyes him. His looks are always suspicious. He gets in trouble for it in the pub all the time. You should be asleep, he tells the pony. The pony turns his head towards Steve as if to say, so should you. Steve accepts that the pony has a point. The pony continues his slow walk, moving across the high street and down the passage alongside the greetings card shops, stopping to nuzzle something in a dustbin along the way. Axley belongs to Steve once again. Steve rubs his fingers across the brass plaque on the bench. Debbie's name, the date of her birth, the date of her death. He presses record on his dictaphone, because otherwise he would just be a man on a bench talking to himself. Hey, Debs. We came second in the quiz yesterday. Norman from the shop had his brother-in-law staying and he's been on the weakest link, so we had no chance. The gang was going to lodge a complaint, all seemed a bit suspicious, you know? But I took a look at it all when I got back home and
He really is Norman's brother-in-law, so there's not a lot we can do.
Trouble killed a vole. First one in a while. Nice to know he's still got it in him. And he took it into Margaret's house, not ours, so that was a result. Just saw a new cat on Mason's Lane. Ginger, tough guy, you know the sort. Amy's working with Rosie D'Antonio, you know, the writer. Very beautiful, people say, but not my type. I'll send her your love, Amy, not Rosie D'Antonio. I'll get the gossip for you. There's a new pie at the shop. Chicken and something. I think you can just heat it up in the microwave. I'll let you know if I feel adventurous. Nothing else this evening. Love you, Debs. Steve switches off his dictaphone and puts it back in his pocket. He pats the bench. Love you, doll. I'm going to see if that cat is still around. Steve begins his walk back up the high street. Tomorrow he is resuming the search for a dog that got lost on a local campsite. The owners, down from London, were understandably beside themselves. Steve knows how dogs think. He'll find him in no time. £500 they've paid him. Up front, too. Cash. Steve would have done it for £50. Londoners and their money are soon parted. And there's a local shop that has had money go missing from the till. Steve set up a remote camera last week, and he's going to head over to pick up the footage. It's the daughter of the owner. Steve worked that out almost immediately. Steve knows how people think, too. They're surprisingly similar to dogs, in actual fact. But the owner isn't going to believe it was her daughter until she sees the evidence. Axley is peaceful and quiet, and Steve is grateful for it. Other old coppers he knew, they're all in their late 50s now, are still chasing around on dodgy knees for dodgy bosses, drinking or smoking or stressing themselves to death. But Steve understands how life ends, and he has no intention of raging against it. You can't have the thrills of life without the pain of life. So Steve has decided to go without the thrills. He chooses to watch the TV, to do his pub quizzes, to help people when he can, but always to return to his armchair with a cat called Trouble. When you arrest someone, you generally get two different types of reaction. Some people kick and scream all the way to the cells, while others go quietly, knowing the game is up. Who knows when your own game will be up? When you're standing on that platform and the train derails? Whenever it might be, Steve intends to go quietly. Chapter 4. Jeff Nolan, CEO of Maximum Impact Solutions, is thinking about Andrew Fairbanks. People have to be killed sometimes. That's just business. And Jeff understands that more than anyone. But eaten by a shark? Sends a message, Jeff supposes, and perhaps that's the point. When Bella Sanchez had been killed, it hadn't really made much of a splash. Mark Gooch had got people talking a little, joining the dots. But this was the first one to really get serious attention. The first one that had people asking questions. The police, for one. Jeff doesn't like the police visiting him at work. He had tried to be helpful. After all, a young man was dead. But there is, after all, such a thing as client confidentiality. Jeff knows the connection between the three deaths. Knows who's behind them all, too. François Loubet. Jeff has work to do. He's not going to lose his business over three murders, for goodness sake. The police aren't the real problem here. They very rarely are. The real problem is the clients. Already this morning, he'd had a Premier League footballer and a Dutch cannabis importer cancelling their contracts. They no longer had confidence in Maximum Impact Solutions. You couldn't blame them. There would be other calls as news spread. No doubt they'd go to Henk, his former partner and very former best friend. And now Max Highfield, of all people, has paid him a visit. You'd think Max Highfield would have better things to do with his time, and yet here he is, shoes off,
feet on Jeff's boardroom table, stirring up trouble.
"Makes me look bad, Jeff," says Max, running a hand through his hair like a grizzled veteran who has seen too much war, rather than like a man who has just had breakfast at the Ivy.
"I see that, Max," says Jeff. "I see that." Jeff knew it. As soon as Andrew Fairbanks had died, he knew that other clients would start putting two and two together. People Google, especially celebrities. They're never off it.
"How much business do I bring you?" asks Max.
"Oh, plenty. Plenty," says Jeff. "That's why we pay you £750,000 a year, Max." That's Max Highfield's consultancy fee, plus a 10 grand bonus for each new recruit. Introducing other famous people to the business. Actors, mainly. But Max is handsome enough to know everyone.
£750,000? Max laughs. "Do you know what I got for the last Marvel movie?"
"No," says Jeff.
"And you don't need to tell me. I'm sure it's confident."
£8.5 million, says Max.
£8.5 million, and that's pounds, not dollars. You ever been paid £8.5 million for a job, Jeff?"
"I have, yes," says Jeff, "a number of times, but that's beside the point. I understand reputationally that this is difficult for you."
"Three clients dead," says Max, now drumming out a pattern on his voluminous superhero thighs. "That's a lot of dead clients."
"I mean," says Jeff, playing devil's advocate here, "between us, not big clients, small fry, with all due respect to their souls. It's not like Andrew Fairbanks was going to win an Oscar any day soon. He was a fitness influencer." Max suddenly turns very serious. He even takes his feet off the boardroom table.
"Oscars are overrated, Jeff. It's all politics."
"I'm sure," says Jeff.
"Now, if..." "A lot of great actors never won an Oscar," says Max.
"Agreed, agreed. So here's my plan," says Jeff.
"Samuel L. Jackson has never won one. Did you know that?"
Max Highfield is shaking his head slowly and sadly.
"I confess I didn't," says Jeff. "I've got an operative on the scene in South Carolina where Andrew Fairbanks was murdered. She's..."
"Travolta's never won one," says Max.
"Johnny Depp?
Jason Statham?"
"It's politics. Your face has to fit."
"I'm going to speak to her," says Jeff. "Make discreet inquiries."
"Sorry, you're asking who to do what?" says Max. "We were talking about the Oscars, bro."
"I'm saying I have an operative in South Carolina," says Jeff again.
"Amy Wheeler. She looked after you briefly years ago."
"I remember her," says Max. He stares at Jeff intensely for a while. He has clearly been told at some point that his intense stare is effective.
"Tom Cruise, there's another one. Jeff, has anyone ever told you that you look like a black Jason Statham?"
Jeff decides he might as well just plough on.
"It's all delicate, Max. I'm sure you get it," says Jeff.
"You know the nature of the business, but I want you to know we're taking this very seriously."
"I'm thinking of joining Hank,"
says Max, putting his feet back on the table.
"I thought I should let you know. I bet he'd pay more money too."
"Well, I'd be shocked if you weren't thinking about it," says Jeff. Max Highfield would be Hank's highest profile steal yet. "And we can talk about money.
Amy Wheeler was the one who stopped me riding my motorbike off that bridge," Max says.
"That was her," says Jeff. "I believe you'd taken too much of your painkiller medication."
"They don't tell you not to mix it with whiskey," says Max.
"Don't they?" Jeff says. "I'm sure I've heard somewhere that..."
"And she bled all over my denim jacket."
"To be fair," says Jeff, "she broke up a fight you'd started in a bar and someone attacked her with a piece of broken glass."
"Harry Styles gave me that jacket," says Max.
"Max," says Jeff, looking to wrest back the conversation. "Will you trust me for the next few weeks until we can find out what's going on?"
"Course, course," says Max. "Couple of weeks."
Max begins to slip his shoes on, the signal that he is ready to move on to the next stop in Max's world. Jeff stands. Loved the new film, by the way. Rampage 7.
Thanks, man, says Max. I wasn't in love with Rampage 6, but we're back on track here. And it's nice to play triplets.
Jeff nods in agreement. As one of the triplets, Max has a moustache, and as one of the other triplets, he has an eye patch and a French or possibly Dutch accent.
Henk said someone needs to teach you how to hold a gun properly, but I loved it, says Jeff. I hold them sideways too sometimes.
Henk said that.
Max stands to his full height. The full 6'4" that meant Max wasn't stuck acting in minor British soap operas for long.
Afraid so.
Huh,
says Max, a man who has been given something to think about.
Not everyone gets cinema, says Jeff. I am misunderstood. As a man, says Max, and as an artist. And that's Britain all over.
Terrible country, agreed, says Jeff, his extended hand engulfed in Max's. I'll get this sorted. As Max leaves, a heady haze of testosterone and Tom Ford lingering behind him, he passes Susan Knox on her way in to see Jeff. As he passes her, Max gives her a firm pat on the backside.
There she is, says Max, my hot cougar.
She's the head of HR, Max, says Jeff.
She doesn't mind, says Max over his shoulder as he leaves the room. It's a compliment.
I'm guessing you do mind, says Jeff, inviting Susan to sit. That sort of thing.
That sort of thing. Yes, says Susan impassively. I mind that sort of thing.
Would you like me to do something? Jeff asks. Dismantle the patriarchy? Suggests Susan. I'll talk to them, says Jeff. They don't really like black guys interfering, but I'll do my best. Is that the François Loubet file? Susan nods and places the file on Jeff's desk.
May I ask why you wanted it?
They had done a job for Loubet around 2 years ago. Didn't meet him, of course. No one meets François Loubet. He's the world's biggest money smuggler and, as such, likes to keep himself to himself. They were protecting one of his staff. Henk had objected at the time. He was always a bit more particular than Jeff when it came to their clients. But as Jeff had said at the time, if you don't protect criminals, you very soon run out of clients. Henk will discover this in his new business. Perhaps this row had been the beginning of the end for the two of them. Jeff opens the file and looks at Susan.
Have you read it?
Have I read it? Susan asks. No, it's confidential. Jeff nods. Of course she's read it. That's okay. Susan reads everything, but she knows how to keep quiet. On top of the file is the printout of an email message Jeff had sent to François Loubet a few months ago, before the killings had started. Evidence, if he ever needs it.
Monsieur Loubet, I trust this email finds you well. You will remember we carried out some work for you around 2 years ago. Your prompt payment was greatly appreciated. I write with troubling news, however. If I might express myself plainly, two of my clients have recently been caught carrying large sums of money through international customs. This leads me to believe that my firm is being targeted by a professional money smuggling syndicate, and the only money smuggler who has had any connection with Maximum Impact Solutions is you. Your urgent help is needed in providing information that could assist me. Can we talk? I'm afraid I cannot let this threat to my company continue, and I will take all the steps necessary to protect my clients and my business. Which also means that if you yourself, François, are behind it, which I believe you are, I will hunt you down. Yours faithfully, Jeff Nolan. Jeff looks up from the printout.
You know what François Loubet does for a living, Susan?
Susan shakes her head. Without looking at his file, I would have no way of knowing. Perhaps you accidentally glanced at the file one day, though, while making copies, something like that. If I had glanced at it, says Susan, and such things happen, I would say he was the world's leading money smuggler, is the number one name on the FBI's most wanted list and has recently been in email correspondence with you.
That was a hell of a glance, says Jeff.
I do a lot of photocopying, replies Susan. I also understand that no one knows who he is.
Jeff nods. You see why I'm looking at his file now?
Andrew Fairbanks, found with all that money, Susan suggests.
On top of everything else you might have accidentally glanced at in the file, says Jeff.
It's certainly a situation, says Susan.
But you've been in situations before and you always seem to struggle free.
I hope you'll be able to do so on this occasion. It will be useful to identify him, so is there anything I can do to help?
Is there anyone with Amy Wheeler, Jeff asks, on the Rosie D'Antonio job?
An ex-Navy SEAL called Kevin, says Susan.
As always, she has the answer to hand. That's why Jeff doesn't mind her looking at documents. Not all documents, of course.
He's not one of ours, says Jeff.
Booked through a local affiliate, says Susan. Perfectly adequate, by all accounts, and a clean bill of health from the Lewisport Police Department.
Amy's recent client history makes for interesting reading, says Jeff, given the killings. What would your view be on that, as head of HR?
As head of HR, I would say you need to speak to her as a matter of urgency, says Susan.
I would bring her home immediately.
Susan has worked with him since his earliest days in the city. Jeff would say that she's been with him through thick and thin, but honestly, there hasn't been all that much thin.
Jeff thinks about his next move. Amy will have worked out that the three murders mean big trouble for her. She will have realised that everything is pointing to her. He decides he will message her, bring her back to London, and see her reaction. Jeff picks up another piece of paper from his desk. Thank you for the plot synopsis for Rampage 7, by the way. He had been reading it just before Max Highfield arrived.
It was a pleasure, says Susan.
Well, it was excruciating, but I live to serve.
Jeff looks at Susan again. He would be lost in this place without her. His eyes and ears, his wise counsel, he owes her.
I'm going to do something about Max Highfield, he says. His behaviour is unacceptable.
Susan stands.
I just want to do my job, Jeff. Now bring Amy Wheeler home. She might be in danger.
Hmm, says Jeff.
Susan leans across and puts her hand on Jeff's.
I love you, Jeff, but I don't need you to save me from Max Highfield. I can take care of him myself. Do you understand?
Jeff understands and is grateful. Max is worth an awful lot of money to him. He would be worth an awful lot of money to Henk, too. Henk Van Veen. He and his old friend built this place together. Butch and Sundance, Cagney and Lacey. Then, 3 months ago, the split.
Perhaps it was to do with Lube. You could never tell with Henk.
Jeff looks over at a long mirror on the far wall of the boardroom. Behind it is Henk's secret den. He would sit there, deadly quiet, in an armchair, tumbler of brandy in hand, and watch meetings through the mirrored glass. He said it was to add an extra layer of security to their business, but really it was to make sure no one was talking about him. That was Henk. Suspicious. Paranoid. Useful skills in their business, but irritating in a business partner. Everyone quickly found out about the secret den, though, largely because Jeff quickly told them about it. Thereafter, whenever anyone wanted to talk about Henk, they would go to the pub instead.
Jeff looks at Susan. May I ask you one more question?
Fire away, says Susan. Jeff picks up the Lube file again. Do you think Henk has ever looked at this file?
Oh, Henk looked at everything, says Susan.
Chapter 5.
What are you up to? Asks Steve. The phone is cradled between his shoulder and his ear, both hands rubbing Trouble's head. If you rubbed his head with only one hand, he let you know you were doing a poor job.
Sitting by a pool drinking a protein shake, says Amy. You?
Watching Tipping Point while eating a Scotch egg, says Steve.
Where's your client? Shouldn't you be with her?
She's in an oxygen tent, says Amy. She's meditating. What's tipping point?
What's tipping point? Says Steve. You're serious.
I'm guessing it's a game show, says Amy.
Too right, it's a game show.
What's tipping point, indeed?
Sometimes Steve wonders what world Amy is living in.
Everybody knows tipping point.
Can you go for a walk or something? Asks Amy. Do some taekwondo, get some fresh air.
I've got the window open, says Steve,
and I've already been for two walks. I walked to the shop to get this scotch egg, and I walked home again.
You shouldn't eat scotch eggs, says Amy. They're not real food, they're ultra-processed.
That's why they're so delicious, says Steve.
You have to eat properly, okay? Amy says. How are those organic vegetable boxes I ordered for you?
Steve looks through to the kitchen and sees a pile of uneaten vegetables. Bob from the bakery comes to get them once a week for his compost heap.
Terrific, says Steve.
Courgettes, all sorts.
He knows he won't get away with that easily. Amy is a trained interrogator.
And how do you cook courgettes? Amy asks.
Well, you know, says Steve. You must have seen this somewhere on a TV show.
Chop them up, whack them in a pan.
Uh-huh.
Bit of oil, bit of salt.
That sounds convincing. And anyway, she can't prove anything.
Steve, have you eaten anything from any of the boxes?
Not yet, admits Steve.
I've been too busy to cook. I gave Margaret next door some spring onions and an aubergine, though.
I just don't want you to die, says Amy. I know that's selfish of me.
I don't want you to die either, but I don't stop you flying off around the world with guns.
Sometimes you need to go on the attack with Amy. That's what she respects.
I know, says Amy, but that's different. I'm me.
Scotch eggs and guns are the same thing, Amy. There's an equivalence.
How's Rosie D'Antonio? Diva?
Not yet, says Amy. I quite like her.
Would you get a nose job if you were me?
I once got my nose broken, says Steve.
A woman in a pub with a brick was trying to arrest her brother on the Old Kent Road.
What's an oxygen tent?
A tent full of oxygen, says Amy. Anything interesting on?
A lost dog, says Steve. Londoners.
What's the weather like?
Sunny, says Amy.
You'd hate it. You'd melt.
What SPF factor are you wearing?
I don't believe in it, says Amy.
I sweat a lot. It protects me naturally.
Jesus, Amy, says Steve. 30 on the arms, 50 on the face.
So no one's shot at her yet?
Not yet, says Amy.
Where's the dog, do you reckon?
Having fun, I expect, says Steve. Sniffing trees. I've got a plan, though.
You've always got a plan.
When am I going to see you next?
Margaret was asking after you. She'd like to see you.
Straight after this, there's the Diamond Conference in Dubai, says Amy. I'm going to join Adam there.
You should come out.
To Dubai?
Never going to happen in a million years.
They've rented us a villa, says Amy.
Pack your trunks and fly out.
I don't have trunks, says Steve.
I think they sell them in shops, says Amy.
And I don't fly, says Steve, sitting next to people.
What if they want to talk to me?
No one wants to talk to you, don't worry.
And there's the pub quiz on the Wednesday, says Steve.
And I've got some shelves arriving. I have to sign for them, so no can do.
Margaret could sign for the shelves, suggests Amy. He can hear that she knows it's a losing battle, but bless her, she always tries.
You could fly from Southampton Airport. I've looked into it.
Southampton, says Steve.
There's roadworks on the A31. How long's that going to take me?
How's Adam?
You tell me. He said he rang you at the weekend?
Oh, yeah, of course he did, says Steve.
Another lie. He should honestly just answer no comment to everything Amy asks. It would save him a lot of trouble.
He's very well, enjoying himself, missing you.
He didn't ring you, did he?
Of course he didn't, says Steve.
What would we talk about?
Anything, you're his dad. What do we talk about?
Dogs, scotch eggs, oxygen tents, my failings as a human being.
You could talk to him about that.
With Adam?
Come on, Ames. Those are our things.
I'll tell him to ring you, says Amy.
He's in Macau.
Is he? Says Steve, wondering where Macau might be. He'll look it up. It's exactly the sort of thing that comes up at the quiz.
No sign of the Russians, then? No hitmen?
We're on a private island, Steve, says Amy.
The only people who could kill me here are Rosie and an ex-Navy SEAL called Kevin. I promise I'm safe.
Eyes open, though.
Eyes open always, says Amy.
Shall we talk again later?
Later is good, says Steve.
Just got the dog thing and a pub lunch, and someone's nicking money from a shop.
Home in time for stopping point?
Tipping point, says Steve.
Don't talk to strangers.
What was that thing Debbie used to say?
Amy asks.
A stranger's just a friend you haven't met yet?
She nicked that from a film, says Steve. She'd fly out to Dubai, says Amy.
I wouldn't stop her, says Steve.
Let her sit in those roadworks.
You'd go with her, Steve, says Amy. You know you would.
Not with these shelves on, though, why I wouldn't, says Steve.
Debbie or no Debbie.
You'd be powerless, says Amy.
I'm going to raise a glass to her when I get off the phone.
She'd have got on with Rosie.
She'd have loved a private island. If we ever got one of the private booths at Nando's, she was beside herself.
Take care, Pops, says Amy. Talk later.
Love you, Ames. And you're definitely safe.
Love you too. And yes, I promise I've never been safer.
Steve removes a hand from Trouble's head and gets an admonishing look. He switches his phone off.
He always cries after a call with Amy. He doesn't know why, but he's learnt to accept it.
As the tears come, Trouble stretches a paw up to Steve's chest. Probably hungry.
Chapter 6.
Felicity Wollaston knows she should move to a new office. What with all the money coming in now. But she likes it here. Two rooms above a travel agent on Letchworth Garden City High Street. It suits her. Quiet, no passing traffic. No clients eager to hop on a train and experience the bustling Letchworth lifestyle. Just Felicity, a fish tank, and Classic FM. She should also get staff. She knows that too. But who could she trust in the current situation? Her setup has been the same for nearly 40 years now. Just Felicity herself, taking care of her clients, and Felicity, using a slightly different voice, as her own receptionist. In truth, she'd never been busy enough to need staff, or rich enough to pay them. Two things that have both changed in the last 2 years, for reasons she has yet to entirely fathom. She looks out of her window onto Letchworth High Street. A man rides a mobility scooter into the W.H. Smith opposite. A teenager on a lunch break smokes a cigarette on a bandstand. And a man in a suit, let's assume an estate agent, is leaning on an open car door, talking on a mobile phone. To his wife, to a buyer. Difficult to tell, but either way she can see that he is lying. She had been ready to retire until all